Hello and welcome to Unity Quest episode 429. I am newly minted Hollow Knight super fan, Mike Apps, aka Wheels, with me as always.
Newly minted Dispatch super fan, David McCrony, Fanboy Master.
Vintage Saga super fan, your managed fan, Michael Baker, Chidamu Gatari.
That's why you'll always have a home here.
It's true.
Yep.
It's another week. Rumored Nintendo Direct has not surfaced yet.
I mean, I wasn't expecting it to have surfaced by February 2nd as of this record.
But I want gives.
Wheels, did you suffer like a brain bleed partway through that sentence?
Yes.
Okay, well, I'm glad you seem to have recovered just as quickly. Let's see. Let's do a quick round of what we've been playing.
Well, I was playing Dungeons of Dreadrock last week, and I actually beat the final boss we were wrapping up last week. I need to finish up that adventure corner for it. It's cute.
Fair enough.
I was going through my shelf of Switch games I haven't actually done anything with yet, and realized I still had this copy of Romancing Saga 3. I'm playing through that.
Yeah. Good call.
That seems like a pretty good one to play.
Enjoying a legitimate English translation this time.
Yeah, who'd you pick for your run?
Thomas. Just because I never got I never really understood the point of the merchant minigame when I originally played it. Whether it was in the less than ideal illegitimate translation phase or just plain Japanese. I figure, you know what, I will figure
Let's
this
see if
out.
We can crack this nut.
And I've already beaten that quest, so yeah.
Well, good work.
Yep. Oh no, currently I just managed to survive the boss at the bottom of Dead Man's Well by the skin of my teeth, and now I have two fairly peeved archmages waiting for me at the entrance to the well. Still trying to figure out a good way of beating them. Working on it. I may have to go back to a previous save and build up a little bit more and have somebody with a defensive fire spell.
Yep. Well, that's Saga's always a good call as far as this podcast is concerned.
Oh, yes.
Wheels, what have you been up to?
Aside from review game, which I can't talk about.
Still.
Still? Oh, okay, what's the ETA on when you can actually talk about it?
I would have to look at the agreement.
Next week? Week after next?
Probably middle of the month. Possibly
later.
Wow,
okay. Okay, well, something for us to look forward to.
Yeah. I have been continuing to play some Silksong, and my son, even though it's not part of his I want to play Grand Theft Auto challenge, is also playing Silksong. And
now he'll also play the DLC.
we both remarked, as he kept asking me questions about the early game areas, I don't remember any of these because they all looked the fucking same. Except for one.
I mean, that's kind of the opening of the first one as well, so I wouldn't be surprised if that changes.
Yes and no.
I'm speaking specifically of the first couple areas.
Yeah,
maybe.
Like the first two areas of Hollow Knight are pretty samey. Like the first six areas of Silksong are pretty samey and kind of unremarkable.
I wonder if that betrays its origin as a DLC that was initially trying to keep its amount of new assets down.
It's possible.
It's possible.
I mean, there's some memorable bosses. I couldn't tell you what area any of them are in, but I mean, like all the areas, I could tell you the boss of every area in Hollow Knight, but definitely not Silksong. Oh, hey. Oh, hey, speaking of the child, he's here right now. Yes, I agree. Silk Song is not for the weak.
His Psycho Circus, the Nightmare Child. So, played anything other than Silk Song?
Well, I will say that Act 2 is mostly one giant area and is much more remarkable, so that's good.
As Act 2s tend to go.
Yeah. other than that, not too much. I wish I was prepping for Dragon Quest VII Reimagined, but not going to be playing much of that till the review game is done. So
I'm going to report in on two things real quick-like. So first of all, it had been my intention to be finished with Expedition 33 by this point, but life got in the way, and also, like, there's not actually a lot of momentum in Act 2. This is going to be, like, the new thing that I whine about for probably too long, but basically the quick and dirty of it is that the game story just doesn't have that much momentum. You play an old-school RPG, which this is definitely inspired by, and, like, you get to a new area, and there's, like, a subplot or, like, some sort of plot propulsion there. And I would say that's probably only, like, every third area in this. So, like, I got through a dungeon. What happened? Nothing. It was just a thing that was between you and the next area. There's some stuff, like... Well, I can't talk about, but then, yeah, it just, you know, I feel like they're kind of hamstrung by certain story decisions they've made that I can't bring up because they would be spoilers. There's, like, two things that I would count as spoilers that I could, that have essentially existed in this plot so far, and that's kind of the problem, is that it's just, like, it seems like... it just seems like there's a lot of area without a lot of momentum, but pressing forward, I think I'm like two-thirds of the way through Act 2, halfway, I don't know. But yeah, getting on with things. I think I've got all the characters I'm gonna get. The new character you get at the start of Act 2 is narratively difficult to wrangle with because he obviously knows basically the entire plot but can't say anything.
Well, that's not helpful.
Because then he would be telling you the entire plot. And he has... There's a scene with him that is just, like, one of the most, like, psychotic jokes I have ever seen. Like, a joke that I can't imagine landing with any actual human being. And I think there's a way for that to work as characterization, except for the fact that everyone in the party laughs at it. And I hate that I have to skirt around this, because it would involve explaining more about this character. But it's a truly deranged scene. It was interesting, at least, so I'll give it that. Like, a lot to unpack there. But ultimately, my attempts to finish it got waylaid by the fact that I played something else and had just a much easier time, feeling connected to its world and characters. As I hinted at the start of this isn't per se an RPG, but we would probably be able to cover it in Adventure Corner.
Oh, for sure.
Mm-hmm. I was playing Dispatch, which I did not have high expectations for because... So it was made by the people who made the Telltale games, like a bunch of them splintered off into this company ad hoc. And the later Telltale games really left me cold. Basically anything past The Walking Dead, it was just like, this is dour and self-serious, and the the jokes are not landing, and there's just not enough going on in it. And this mostly down to just having a really charming world and writing manages to avoid all of those problems. The premise is that you are a dispatcher for a company that has superheroes on call as private security. So the core, like, when you're not doing the narrative, like, Telltale thing, where, like, the game is giving you some dialogue options and giving you about 5 seconds to decide what you're going to say. If you are... so, like, most episodes, although not all of them, will start with you do some dialogue options to sort of, like, set the tone for what is this episode about. It's split into 8 episodes. But you do some dialogue options to set in motion, like, what is this episode about? What is it focusing on? And then you get sent into the dispatch section. And the dispatch section is sort of like a mini, like, strategy type thing, where basically you get different calls. You have a certain amount of, like, each of them has a certain amount of time to do, and they will give you, like, sort of hints as to, well, we need a hero that can do X and is good at Y. So it's like you use your intuition based on your stats, each hero's stats. You send them along to see to try to get the issue resolved. But once they've been sent out, they need a little bit of time to leave, do the mission, and return and rest. So you have to make sure that you haven't sent, like, you since you're also deciding their stat loadout, you're making sure that you have a team that can do a lot of different things at different times. And, like, if you're really bad at these, it simultaneously does a lot and only does a little. Because, like, heroes only get experience if the mission they went on was a success. And different heroes will have different, natural skills that can proc based on, like... There's one superhero that has, like, really high stats, but they also have a skill called depression that means that if they ever... If their mission fails, they have to rest for a long time because they are depressed. And, like, you can get... you can get really, really busted ones. There's, like, one of them has a skill that allows them to get a... since certain missions will have as many as 4 people being... give you the option to send as many as 4 people. One of the characters gets this truly insane... you can, if you get train them up properly, they get a truly insane buff called Spread Thin, which makes it so mm-hmm. that every slot that isn't filled massively buffs their stats.
Ooh.
So they get really strong in those situations. Certain characters like each other, so they will perform better if they are sent on the same mission. So, like, one of my favorite stupid things I did was, like, early on I had 2 characters go out, and they got into a debate about who got to call themselves the Fight Man. And then I was able to settle that dispute by telling them that they should form a dynamic duo. And after that, they got synergy bonuses every time, as they had dubbed themselves the Fight Men. It's a lot of fun. It's got really sharp dialogue, really great voice acting. It's only like 6 to 8 hours long. It does a good job of being reactive to your choices, both... There's one particular character who a lot of their, like, you can, like, how their story resolves is heavily tied into both what you say to them and how well you treat them when you're doing your dispatch job. So even though most of the dispatches don't technically have a fail state, there is still, like, narrative weight to being good at the dispatch sections. So yeah, it's really good. It's a lot of fun. It's really funny. I've really, really appreciated it. It was a big surprise. It would have snuck on to my like probably top five games from 2025 if I had played it in time.
Wow.
I really recommend it if any of that sounded compelling to you. Especially, the other reason I didn't expect to take to it is that I'm tired of a lot of superhero things. And this did not cause that fatigue at all. I had a great time. I would play a second season in a heartbeat. Highly recommended.
Sweet.
And it's now out on PC, Switch, Switch 2. I think it came out on the other consoles when it first came out, but I'll double check. But yeah, it's on everything.
Apparently it was minorly censored for the Switch version. I'm not sure how.
Yeah, so basically the PC version has a little toggle that basically censors out all the dicks and boobs. And that toggle was set to always be on. What's that?
I figured it was something like that. I remember Cyberpunk had to do something similar.
Yeah, they did that in Japan only, which is what threw people.
Yeah.
Cyberpunk is censored in Japan on Switch 2, but not in the rest of the world. There's some ongoing discussion between Ad Hoc and Nintendo about seeing what they can do about that. And so they've promised some of the censorship will probably be lifted by a patch in the next few weeks. Honestly, I don't think it changes that much.
I would hope it doesn't, because if it did, I'm going like, what kind of narratives are we getting into here? I was going to say, Japan's still got laws in the books about pretty much the only thing you could regularly have censored anywhere in Japanese media is genitalia.
Mm-hmm.
But the amount of censorship has never been formally defined. So over the years they have reduced it down from obvious pixelating everything out of everything down to it just needs some thin black bars across it.
Yeah.
It's kind of insane how detailed you can get with a few very thin black bars involved. And I'm quite sure that this is nothing approaching what would be in this game, mainly for the fact that I seriously doubt they have that level of graphical fidelity. I would hope they would not have that level of graphical fidelity in this game.
So there's a lot of dick and balls. Like, there are definitely dick and balls.
Yes, but I'm talking like dedicated Japanese erotic manga levels of detail, which would be freaking insane, and also quite likely illegal to sell in several other countries' markets that they're in.
Some of this seems to have been down to it being a global SKU. So because of launching that way, and like there's some ambiguous statements about various ratings boards, which leads me to believe, because this was the version that launched the Japanese version. So that's likely where a lot of this did end up coming from. They made a global SKU and then they launched.
Australia had some things to do with this as well.
What's that?
Australia's ratings board has been like proverbially...
Oh yeah, yeah. I could see Australia's rating board having some issues.
For decades now.
The reason that this likely happened is they made a global SKU while they were launching it in several markets that would have considered the uncensored original problematic, and they're seeing what they can do about restoring some of the content. Ultimately, like I said, because of the way they censor it, they don't cut things, they don't change the shot framing, they just put a big old black bar there. You really don't miss much. It's just like, there will be situations where it's like someone is commenting on the upsetting shape of a supervillain's dick. And you're just going to be seeing a black bar. I think that honestly, in some cases, makes it funnier. But
I was going to say, I mean, for the non-explicitly pornographic Japanese manga, they have fun with this at times. I remember one volume of Monkey Punch's Lupin the Third, where Fujiko was having to seduce a guy, and the guy was very enthusiastic, but instead of just the random censorship, they actually, I can't even remember exactly what ship they used, but it was just a very ridiculous, obvious censorship bar. And yeah, it was hilariously done as a joke.
Yeah, very early Lupin would sometimes do a thing where, like, to imply sex, it was just, like, a male symbol, a male gender symbol penetrating a female gender symbol.
It was a variation on the male gender symbol, but I'm pretty sure there was a happy face involved as well. I think this was from, like, the 2006 manga reboot. Sometime around there. About 20 years ago. So, but yeah, it was... I mean, very obvious. I mean, there was no waffling about what the actual situation was. They just had a lot of fun messing with censorship rules. And that's honestly a lot more fun, or a lot more interesting than simple little black bars or anything. As long as actual, literal depictions of sex are not the main point of the game. I really doubt it would be with this game.
Yeah, there is one, like, the horniest thing that the game does is also, like, a characterization point, because it is one character having a fantasy about another and realizing, oh, shit. Otherwise, it's, like, you know, it's fairly reasonable about the subject. It's generally pretty frank, but it's generally not a particularly, like... It's obviously not pornography or anything. It's fantastic. It's really, again, it's really funny. It has it has a very good pacing. It fucked me up when I realized that, like, the protagonist is voiced by Jesse Pinkman from Breaking Bad, because it's Aaron Paul doing a voice I am not used to him doing. But he's really good. He's got a very good deadpan, sort of dead inside voice. It's just excellent from start to finish. Absolutely loved it. Has just a great cast overall. Some interesting choices that, like, if I were to play the game again, I would actually get a lot of different scenes. And playing the game again is not the worst idea in the world, because it's only, like, 8 hours long.
I was going to say, isn't the Telltale style of game intended for multiple playthroughs, just to see whatever everything
it, that it happens? It is, but a lot of times, like, there were two problems that Telltale ran into a lot. One is they were usually working with someone else's license, which meant there was really only so much they could do. Other was just that, like, the between gameplay was often kind of limited and not super great. This is, like, it's not the most in-depth thing, but there is, like, different build loadouts you could make and different people who might be on your dispatch team, and that will change how things progress. Certain dispatches will only open up if you fucked up a previous one.
That's a nice thing to have, at least.
Yeah. And then there's some fun that comes from, like, so one of the things you get partway through is that, like, hey, it's time to add someone to the team. You can have this, like, veteran, or you can have this guy who was the janitor. And the guy who was the janitor is a fucking Magikarp. Like, he is actively, farcically useless at the start. He has ones in almost every stat. And he, on his first mission, he will injure whoever he goes on the mission with. No escaping that. He just fucks up really bad.
Well,
that's the other thing.
He starts out as a Magikarp. Does he end up as a Gyarados?
Yes, he gets more points per level up. He levels up really fast, and if you send him to be trained by a veteran superhero, he will go he will become like this like weird super healer, so that if he's dispatched with someone who is injured, they will be healed just by having been on the same team as him.
Okay, good.
Yeah. No, it's really good, and like the way that ties in with the plot, where like the protagonist Robert is sort of like is this sort of mentor, the only one who's not clowning on this kid. It fits really well. It's a lot of fun. Yeah, I just like the character dynamics are really the high point. There is an episode that ends with a bar fight that is incredibly funny. Meanwhile, like, and that bar fight is started, in part by God, while one of your like, because the gimmick of this superhero team is that it's the dregs, it's whoever was, who like these like low level villains that have like decided that it would be more profitable to work for this company. So of course they all start out as kind of
Thunderbolts in there too.
Yeah, there's a bit of Thunderbolts, except no one's being coerced. It's just like, this just makes more sense.
Yeah.
But one of them is singing, like, there's one of the other toggles you had on PC to make it easier for people to stream the game was that there is a toggle to determine whether the game plays licensed music. And one of those instances is that one of your assholes on the team is at the karaoke at the bar. Let me pull this up. And he's singing like a fucking like absurd, like an absurdly bad cover of the like 90s one-hit wonder Meredith Brooks Bitch. but he's making fun of Robert, so he's just repeatedly singing, "I'm a bitch, my name's Robert." Incredibly fun. So yeah, this game's great. I haven't tried the Switch 1 version, but the Switch 2 version's fine. But there is a Switch 1 version. I suspect that it runs fine. And I highly recommend it. But that's there's a lot of other. I will not spoil the bar fight, but the bar fight is just an incredible series of truly deranged things. Some of which I didn't get to see because certain characters weren't there. Because you know you have to make choices. I do know that one of the characters that I didn't bring along can be seen during the bar fight in the bathroom snorting a line of coke. It also
okay. Is it Speedster by any chance?
No, he is not.
Okay.
It's well, even better. He's me. Just weird.
Okay.
But yeah, like but that's I just realized as I was saying that's another thing that might have that certain ratings board might not have loved. But yeah.
Oh, that would not have gone with the Japanese ratings board.
Yeah, wouldn't have loved it. Would not have loved it. What I suspect that they will end up doing is they will figure out what they can get away with removing the censorship on while keeping their rating. Because what they seem to have done is they've taken the PC version's like strong content censorship and just forced it to stay on the entire time. And so that means that it's also censoring out some things that are just like, well, no ratings board is going to complain about this. Like, a bunch of characters flip each other off, it censors that out. You can always, obviously... What's even funnier is, there's actually one instance where someone flips someone off, and the censor bars doesn't show up. They just... I guess they missed it. But...
I'm wondering now if it's as simple as them keeping the toggle on, would it be possible to hack it... Open hack it off.
If you could get custom firmware in there, I would suspect you could probably disable the toggle.
It's probably not possible on the hardware, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, if you don't care too much about that, and honestly like, I don't think it really meaningfully affects the game, because it's not like the game hides from you what was happening. It just doesn't show it directly to you. It's incredibly fun. I had a ball with it. I've been waffling on about that for far too long, so let's jump into some of these questions. Some quick ones.
We didn't get into a nice digression on the nature of Japanese censorship rules.
Yeah, that's always fun.
It was not a total digression.
And the game has RPG elements in it. It's probably more of an RPG than FF16.
Lots of things are.
I mean, is that really saying that
much? I can never
much,
resist the joke. Yeah, I know. But I can never resist the joke. Okay, quick ones. Tales of Phantasia Cross got an English patch. That game was bundled together with Tales of Phantasia Narakiri Dungeon Cross on the PSP. Only translated Phantasia portion. Their patch basically disallows you from selecting the Narakiri portion on the ROM. I would suspect that if you were able to select it, it would cause horrible, like, buggy text and maybe crash the game. So I can kind of see why they would force that to happen.
Yeah. A bad translation patch is quite often much, much worse than having it just in Japanese.
But they translated only the bad part of the game.
Narakiri Dungeon might be worse, but I don't know.
I was gonna say, you know what Narakiri Dungeon was originally, right?
Yeah, it was a Game Boy Color game.
No, I mean before that.
It was
Tales of Phantasia started out as Tales Phantasia, a failed attempt at a light novel.
Oh, that's what you mean, yeah.
Yeah, and so when it got adapted, when they took it and basically changed it into a video game, one of the reasons why the original writer eventually left Wolf Studio and formed Tri-Ace was because of all the stuff that they had to cut out. A lot of the cut material for, especially for Douse's backstory, ended up being the core of Narakiri Dungeon. Does it make sense? Not particularly. Because, failed attempt at a Japanese fantasy novel to begin with.
Yeah, no, it's one of those situations where, like, if you, like, the more I learn about the plot of Tales of Phantasia, the more I'm like, oh, yeah, I can see why no one wanted to publish this.
It's a lot of it is based around Douse's backstory from another planet involving some time travel, a few other things, some reincarnation. It just gets, it's weird. And then
we would get Tales of Symphonia, which just wrote an entire backstory for the planet, but thousands of years earlier.
yep. So, if you really like Tales of Phantasia, I could understand why you would want to try Cross, because it is, I was going to say the plot is more of the same, the character system is the basis. I'm going to assume that they probably took some of the stuff from Narakiri Dungeon 2 and 3 for how the costume change system works, because it cannot be the same as it was in the Game Boy Color version. but if it is, then it's actually a fairly decent class change system involved. So, for what it's worth.
Yeah. Phantasia Cross was like an the Phantasia part of Phantasia Cross was an object of some interest, because it was the second time that Phantasia got ported to PSP, and they, like, monkeyed with the combat a little bit. Which is, I suspect, why that portion was the one that was translated. Given that they have, like, gotten that deep into hacking it, I wouldn't be surprised if we see the Narakiri Dungeon Cross portion eventually, but I'm also not surprised that there is less interest in that content in the West.
On the other hand, I mean, it cannot be any worse than Summoner's Lineage.
God.
Yeah. Which was only nominally in the same world as Phantasia.
That's a GBA one, right?
Yeah. It's also it's also a tactical strategy game.
Yeah, yeah.
Where
I remember
the
that.
actual The actual combat system wasn't that bad. It was just that the campaign mode was certainly not balanced with it in mind. So, with the issue being that, I mean, you could summon, I mean, you, your main character had to summon units onto the field for a mana cost, and units could be held over between battles if they survived the previous battle. Strong if. So very often the player was starting off with just the main character, a couple of other important characters who had plot armor to survive, and nothing else for the first few rounds because they have to build up the mana to start summoning anything else. And the enemy side always starts with multiple units on the field of whatever the current R level is, while you're still summoning level ones. It was not a good experience. I somehow beat that game.
It was not a good experience. You shouldn't
have, but... Oh, because it was there and I was reviewing it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Also, I mean, the plot itself wasn't that bad. It was kind of interesting. I just had to get through the battles to get to it. It was one of those examples where a villain really helps make the plot go better. You just wish there were more of him and less of the main characters. Or that they saw any need of bringing the Fantasia cast 200 years across history to join the team. It's like 200 year time skip and Chris and Mint still have not gotten a room. Grace of dudes.
I'm not even surprised.
Yeah. Okay, well, yeah. So anything to talk about besides pointless Tales spinoffs?
Okay, that we've got a couple more bits from Fireminer thus far. If you look at the Twitter threads of the author of Megami Tensei, you realize that his novels contain the knowledge he accrued throughout his life, from feng shui principles he learned from his grandmother to Western occultism he gleaned from foreigners. There are games that rip off the headlines, but have you come across games containing folk knowledge that make you say, only someone who was there could have known it? Like, I know how local, I wonder how local the Boku no Natsu Yasumi games are.
I mean,
Boku Natsu is supposed to be kind of every Japan.
Boku no Natsu Yasumi, that is like some average of an idyllic late Showa period summer vacation.
And the late Showa period aspect of it might count as only someone who was there would do it, but...
No, because that's something that has been so pastiched in various very popular anime and manga series over the years, there is very little chance that that anybody in this country would not recognize it, most of the symbolism involved. A lot of this served as a template for everything that is done for summer vacations since then.
But yeah, I'm trying to think of anything that I would say contains that vague autobiographical element, I would almost say.
If you want one that gets really obscure on stuff, Nightmare Project Yakata.
Oh god.
Aside from the fact that it is it has backstory based on individual novels of a murder mystery series. Very specific backstory elements. And some of the themes in the dungeons go on deep dives of like early 20th century Japanese pulp science fiction. Or known species of the Cambrian explosion. Period. Things like that. Or just stuff like Old Axe, Silver Axe. There's reference to that and Legend of Zelda Link to the Past.
Unending. Everything has that.
Yeah. Or any version of the Little Red Paperclip side quest originally came from a Japanese fairy tale called Warishibe Choja, which my daughter had as a picture book this past month at nursery school, and I have it on the shelf right here now. I mean, just the idea of having something very inconsequential trading up better and better stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's a classic Japanese folktale.
Mm-hmm.
First appeared in Zelda in Link's Awakening.
Yep.
And like required. Intentionally based on this concept.
Mm-hmm. You will sometimes see Warashibe Choja translated as Straw Millionaire for those interested.
Yeah. I mean, the basic idea is like this very poor guy goes to a shrine and prays for some guidance, and the goddess Kanon just tells him to take the first thing that comes to his hand after he leaves the shrine, and it will lead him to fortune, good fortune. And on his way out, he stumbles and he falls, and his hand grabs a piece of straw. And that's what he has to start with. And it trades up very fast.
So. Mm.
Okay. Any other Japanese folktales that you're familiar with?
I'm certainly not going to know all the ones you do.
Yeah.
And if you want proof of that, that's available on Amazon.
Buy my book.
Fair enough. I'm just curious about which ones you know. Which ones you've realized that you have seen.
In like references to them in games, I feel like more oblique references. Like the obvious ones you'll see are stuff like Momotaro gets referenced on occasion. I think I've seen things always that are like probably meant to be allusions to Urashima Taro. But
well, like what?
It's been a minute. Like there's things that I can think that like are at the edge of my memory that I feel like they're probably meant to be references to that, but I would have to like dig deeper into what I am recalling. I just feel them on the edge of memory is all.
Yep. Oh, I mean, if we're talking about like Urashima Taro references, Cowboy Bebop, the time capsule episode.
Mm.
Where the time capsule for Faye arrives in it by a little delivery drone with the picture of a turtle on the side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the best episodes, too.
And as a counter joke, the little delivery drone that arrives at the end of the episode has a rabbit on it. Or a completely different folktale reference.
There is a tortoise and hare here.
Yes.
Let's see. I am, of course, only as familiar as like the average like weeb about various Japanese folktales, which is why I should purchase on Amazon. I'm trying to get you to plug these things in the middle of the episode so they can't skip it.
Buy my book.
Oh, my book. Okay, it was like Tanuki is a Teapot, available on Kindle and Kindle Unlimited. Yes, animal folktales, lots of fun. I mean, some of them quite a bit more obscure than anything you'll find in the video games.
Yeah, definitely. Some of them don't have really any other extant English version, so.
Yep. Or, I mean, and the few of them that do, it's like you have to really dig to find that particular scholarly translation.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. These will be a little less dry.
That was kind of the intent. At some point, I'm going to be doing a retelling of Lafcadio Hearn's Mugina, just so that it becomes more obvious that Mugina does not mean faceless woman, even though that is like the takeaway that everyone has of it over 100 years later.
So. It's just accreted into the cultural consciousness.
No, I mean the faceless woman thing is a is like a spiritual prank associated with Tanuki and Magina. And Pern obviously did not he had written about these animals before in Japan, or these animal terms, and I don't think he realized that he really should have properly explained what a Mugina was supposed to be at the start of the story again, because a lot of people have read the story without the context of several of his other books and think that it's the name of the monster instead of the monster being a trick that the animal trickster is playing. Mugina is literally small fuzzy animal.
Goddamn triple.
Which small fuzzy animal? That is up for debate, because it has been decided by judicial inquiry as multiple different species over the centuries. As Japan accidentally ended up with more kanji for small fuzzy animals than they actually had species of small fuzzy animals.
Huh. That's why they had to import records.
Yeah.
That's a grim joke, actually. I apologize. let's see.
Okay. Yeah.
For those unaware, certain non-native species of raccoon were introduced to Japan because an anime adaptation of the book Rascal made them look like good pets, and apparently some people never watched the ending.
Oh, dear.
I mean, if they had read the book itself was like, yeah, this little guy's
a bad idea. A hand.
Yeah. At least they didn't try to import skunks for the same reason.
Ugh. Why would you do that?
Because the main character, the little girl who has all the pets in Rascal, also has pet skunks.
Oh, Lord.
It's actually fairly trivial to descent them, to remove the scent.
Yeah, I know.
It just has to be done every few months because it will grow back.
Oh.
Skunk started to stink again.
Yep. And, honestly, skunks are... they're adorable, and they are surprisingly friendly with people.
As opposed to raccoons.
If they already know you, then they're fine. Yeah. So... they are not bad pets as long as you take care of the scent.
Yeah, there's just a lot of work. There's a lot of upkeep involved.
Yeah. I mean, they're just slightly friendlier ferrets, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The Fire Miner has one more in Pike, kind of related. Shin Megami Tensei can go quite deep into Japanese Shintoism and Buddhism, but like the mythologies they use are still pretty recognizable to most of Japan, correct? I haven't played Cosmology of Kyoto.
Yeah.
What's that?
He said
I was going to say, yeah, I mean like...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like Devil Summoner Raido number one was based entirely around a long-term political issue between the two groups of deities in Japan. Mm-hmm. So, yep.
That's kind of
granted.
What,
most...
Okay.
Yep. Are you saying yes?
Oh, I was just... Shin Megami Tensei 4 Apocalypse kind of does that, but for global deities.
Several of the Shin Megami Tensei games do that for global deities, but yeah. I mean. I'm not sure how well versed your average Japanese person would be on a lot of the old Shinto mythology, but they do have, I don't know how many published versions of Shintoism for Dummies, basically.
Yeah. I'd expect that they might not grasp all the specifics, but they have at least some cultural, I'm aware of what this is.
Yeah. I mean, there's a fair level of cultural awareness of, okay, I recognize that name. And if anybody wishes to look deeper into it, there is no lack of material to explain it to them.
But finishing out this question, I haven't played Cosmology of Kyoto or a lot of the horror visual novels set in rural Japan, but I heard some of them refer to some pretty obscure local Japanese myths. Is there a game like that about Judeo-Christian religions, like a visual novel that talks about some obscure local saint? I'm not aware of any such thing. You'll get some...
Sorry, I missed part of that question.
Like he was basically... I'm saying he was basically pivoting to, like, there are some Japanese games, like, especially indie ones, that will have elements of their story based on quite localized myths. And he pivoted the question to ask about whether any games had done that for, like, Judeo-Christian. I can't think of anything. The closest I could think of is, like, that, you know, Japanese games will love pilfering from things that are relatively obscure in the West because, like, they have relatively few adherents, so things that involve Gnosticism or Biblical Apocrypha are often quite confusing, especially when they're also ensconced in a Blue Jeans ad, but... But yeah, that's close second.
I understood the reference.
For the thing about local mythology, the fun thing about Shinto is
everything.
Make something up. I mean, all you have to do is make it seem plausible as a local myth, and it will work. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm not sure which games or anime or manga he's thinking about, but the ones I can think of off the top of my head, almost certainly none of those are based off of actual local legends. It's more like, this is something that could conceivably sound like a good local legend. So. And again, it works. And so things like, oh, don't disturb this little Hokura shrine because there is an evil spirit encased within and it might escape, is a really common plot element because that is just the kind of thing that would show up in an old Japanese ghost story.
Hmm.
So, never any specific spot because the ghost stories were never that specific either, unless you're talking about from Shin Megami Tensei. I know he showed up in the Raido games. Ichimokuren looks like a giant red eyeball floating tentacle thing.
Mm-hmm.
You might remember him. There is a very specific rock in Mie Prefecture that he is buried under. Like, by local tradition, he was like one of almost pre Shinto local deities, and they banished him by burying him under a rock, and he's still supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
He was like a wild storm deity originally. Okay, I mean stuff like that. You'll just find random stuff like that all over, and it's much easier to just make one up that sounds right than to borrow an actual spot.
Okay. So I got another one. Whenever people talk about Def Jam or Onimusha 2 or games of that nature, it's always about how celebrities nowadays know about the profitability of games and celebrities back then didn't. I mean, it was also probably... In the case of Onimusha 2, it was also the estate of the actor not being as concerned with profitability. But it really feels like the PS2 era was the high point of actor likenesses actually appearing in games. For example, do you think there is a... did you know there's a PS2 slot machine game called Beast Sap starring MMA fighter Bob Sapp? Oh, Bob Sapp was many things more than an MMA fighter in Japan, but yes, I was aware of that game. please direct yourself to his incredible music video Sap Time.
What?
I'm just gonna post Sap Time in your Discord.
Oh god.
He was in a lot of Japanese pop culture at the time. You know what? Deserved. A lot of fun.
Yeah.
Okay, I need to turn this off because I will get distracted by it.
Yes. Go ahead.
The Sap Time is beautiful. There's also a trilogy of comedic Jidegeki game adventure games called Akudaikon. Let's not get started on an FMV game like Zero Story. Akudaikon, I recall being kind of having like strategy game elements. My understanding is that Akudaikon is a pretty like generic term for like evil magistrate.
Yeah, or like minister of evil.
Yeah, like some sort of evil government role.
Yeah. I mean, the prime minister of evil. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just an odd little game, but I'm not sure how much, how many celebrity likenesses that actually had. I've never looked into it. It looks like, there's some live action cutscenes in this damn thing. Okay. Fair enough. One of the many reasons that did not come out in America. I think, it really comes down to that era is the point where you could where like a lot of people would consider being in a game kind of found money. After that it's like, wait, Grand Theft Auto sold how many copies? Yes, I will be demanding actual pay. So, you win some, you lose some. Capcom somehow has continued to negotiate the likeness rights for Onimusha 1 and 2. 3 might be hard, because it has two different celebrity likenesses in it, but I guess we'll see if they try it. Kind of just a nexus of this was the time to do it. A lot of the people in Def Jam were also in there because it's like, I think they struck a deal with Def Jam, like the actual label. And so like, well, you're going to be in it. But also like a lot of them thought it was cool as hell and had interesting requests for their for their finishing moves. Infamously, there's a story of someone, I can't remember which one, I have a friend who would immediately be able to call this to mind, I cannot remember who this was, but someone who appeared in both Def Jam Vendetta and Fight for New York, during his, appearance for, recording and modeling, he was like, yeah, I want my finisher to be call in a fucking hawk and it, pecks my opponent's eyes. And, the developers were just sort of like, yeah, we'll try. And just sort of relying on the fact that they would not have to work with him again. And then Fight for New York happened, and, apparently, the first thing out of his mouth was, where's my bird? they had some other requests that were just, that they had to just bring out. They were able to convince the person to have a less unfeasible idea, because at least one of them had said, I want, dozens of, women to come up and slap my opponent, and then I just push them over. And it's like, that's not technically feasible at all. We can't do that. I'm sorry. We'll have to figure out something else.
Was it the man ever got his bird?
He did not. There was no bird in either version. The other thing is, you'll find that certain celebrities just think it's fun. It's just like being in things. The funniest of this of the era of celebrities getting into games is that Christopher Walken's in two or three FMV games, because he had essentially told his agent, "I want to be in these things. They're the next thing." Okay. And that's why he's in a fucking Cyberpunk Jack the Ripper FMV game. you can get some dudes with kind of strange. But yeah, you can get some, like you can find people who have interesting motivations, which is honestly where you'll end up finding certain people who appear in current video games, actually.
Now I'm thinking of Space Michael.
Oh God, fucking Space Michael.
Hellish. Where, as I recall, wasn't it just like he was at a party with somebody from Sega, and the guy from Sega was describing Space Channel 9 and or was it 9 or 5, yeah. I can't remember. Hey, Space Channel 5, and Michael Jackson was just like, oh, I want to be in that.
Yeah, there was like a pre-existing relationship because Sega had, in the early 90s, made Michael Jackson's Moonwalker.
Oh, yeah, that was why.
Yeah.
And then his composing team briefly worked on Sonic 3 and Knuckles, which is why Ice Cap Zone's such a fucking banger. But,
I was going to say, a lot of the early, especially the early Sonic games, have a really pop music sound to them. Really nice. Actually, I know that... Oh, never mind, I'll share a song link with you later. Okay, yeah. But yeah, okay.
Okay. Let's hit another couple from Fireminer. Let's see. I've already asked about Anglosphere musicians releasing interactive CDs in the 90s. God. But it's strange when you examine the history of how things went in Japan. There were two interactive CDs released on the PS2 from Morning Musume and Ayumi Hamasaki that were both made using Sony's fancy 360-degree camera. When you consider that PCs weren't as popular in Japan in the early aughts as they were in America, it made sense for interactive CDs to find their way to PS2. Yeah, no, that's like people were going to try that kind of thing. And you get other weirdo things from like non-game celebrities that are extremely funny and weird. I would urge everyone who loves flying shoes to take a look at Gabal Screen. So like to give some context for what Gabal Screen is. It was a game nominally tied in with, I'm given to understand, he's some sort of musician, Tetsuya Komuro, Japanese musician who made like dance, electro dance music. He was apparently quite a big deal in the mid-90s. Wikipedia says he monopolized all top three positions of the copyright distribution rankings for the Jazz Rack Award. Wow. So yeah, he was kind of a big deal in music in Japan at the time. And then he was somehow party to this completely incomprehensibly weird game? We'll say game because it's simpler. Called Gabal Scream. Which, if you've ever watched the surreal YouTube series Classics of Game, which is just like sections of like contextless clips of sections of largely incomprehensible games, Gabal Screen has shown up a few times, I think. Mm-hmm. But a lot of that game is flying around as a shoe for some reason in like a 3D environment. Very low poly, ugly as hell, very strange. There's some FMVs in here of Komodo specifically. It's weird. It's a fucking weird game. There's some beautiful... I'm like Hardcore Gaming 101 has a good article on it that I'm going to show everyone in Wheels' Discord a screen from, because it's a truly like it's such a Dada surreal image of two dolphins, two low poly dolphins surrounding a flying shoe. Cabal screen's weird. I recommend it if you want to play a game that's just complete utter nonsense. But yeah, so, you know, enjoy a ball screen. Sorry,
I'm trying to figure out how to spell that.
G-A-B-A-L-L.
Oh, okay, that easy. Okay.
But yeah, very. I recommend if you like games that just are confusing as hell. Go look it up. You'll have a cabal. But yeah, like this kind of multimedia experiment, kind of a game, kind of something unrelated, is I feel like the inevitable. Consequence of this technology emerging, someone's going to try it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. But yeah, just a strange thing. Recommended in the same vein. Let's see. I actually wrote about Ayumi Hamasaki's interactive CD on a blog. Just Google Kaiokyoku plus Hamasaki Never Ever. That article came about because of another article about the Famicom game TM Network Live in Power Bowl, starring the eponymous band, in which you saw the world save the world from nuclear annihilation. It's interesting to think that Japan already had a video game starring musicians and prominent featuring their music a decade before Queen the Eye or Kiss Psycho Circus, The Nightmare Child. Yeah, you see some like attempts at this as Western game development sort of kicks into gear in the early 90s, although some of them are pretty like there's attempts to incorporate bands and musicians that are largely uninteresting, with things like the Motley Crue pinball game Crewball.
That sounds dreadful.
Mm-hmm. The Dreadful Dead, yes.
But yeah, like God, what was the? I was thinking of another, like, relatively early attempt to incorporate this kind of thing, but it's not coming to me. That sucks. I'll see if I can remember it later in the episode. But yeah, this also has to do with the fact that a lot of early Famicom licensees were companies that had ties to existing entertainment companies in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd kind of see this as like, well, why not? the other thing I was thinking of as like an early like Western company attempts to make use of a band in a way that's just tragically stupid. Revolution X, where you fucking save the world by firing CDs at enemies in order to rescue the band Aerosmith.
Yeah, I was going to say Aerosmith was in that one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Could you choose not to rescue them?
No.
They're awful. Don't rescue them.
I don't want to close my eyes.
Y'all sound so jaded.
Yeah, let's see.
Watch out. Network Janie's got Power a gun.
Ball. Okay, 1989. So yeah, that's pretty damn early. But yeah, you saw a lot of, or not a lot, but you definitely saw some attempts to leverage existing IP in unusual ways. This doesn't really count because it's simply a licensed film game, but it is like one of the most baffling licensed film games on the Famicom. I'm still baffled that there was a video game for the Famicom that was based on the film A Taxing Woman 2.
There was a what?
Really?
Yeah. A video game... a video game based on the second film in the Attacking Woman franchise, Marusa no Onna, which is like mostly sticks out because it's for the late 80s, it's not the kind of property you would think of for video games. Yeah, you know, there's a lot of there's a lot of attempts at making sure to there's a lot of attempts at, well, what is the limit of the Famicom audience? Let's find out. And that produces some of these. Last time you talked, last time you talked about Persona clones, I forgot to ask why there are so many Persona clones for former Atlus employees. Monarch, Varley, Caligula, Effect, is that all they know how to make, or is that the only way they can use their names to get funding? It's the funding thing.
Yeah, probably.
You just say, like, I'm one of the ones that had the secret sauce to that game that sold millions of copies. And it's like, well, please make something that's like that game that sold millions of copies. that's just kind of the way of it. You know. You see that a lot with, like, you know, of course, people who split off from to name a recent object of probably, like, not entirely fair derision, but people who split off from, God, why am I spacing on their name?
Respawn?
Yeah, people who split off from Respawn are going to be asked to make something that looks like Apex Legends, not like Titanfall. Because that's what's going to get them funding, like the thing that was a huge success. So that's kind of the long and short of it. I'm sure that a lot of these developers have tons of ideas for things that, like, don't terribly resemble Persona, or at least are much more in the vein of, like, how Shin Megami Tensei spinoffs would kind of resemble Shin Megami Tensei, but they obviously were quite different. I'm sure plenty of them would love to be doing that, but, you know, you got to do what'll get you funding.
Yeah, and something I talked about before was just the fact that prominent developers leave one company and then make something almost the same as what they did before. And we saw that with Shinji Mikami with The Evil Within and Ifune doing Mighty No. 9. I did find that odd, but I think it just goes back to what you're saying, that that's how they got funding. It was, hey, that was a successful game. How'd you like to make something else like that? And they're probably like, okay, fine. If
I'd like to branch out a bit more, but
yeah,
if they weren't hired away specifically for that in the first place,
right?
On the one hand, for like leaving a company and starting your own, we have got Tri-Ace coming from Wolf Studio, but the other way around, we have Squaresoft hiring pretty much all of most of the staff that made Ogre Battle and Tactics Ogre to end up making Final Fantasy Tactics.
Yeah,
right.
Like most of Quest got folded into Square.
And the guys who started Respawn were unjustly fired from Activision and kind of poached by EA at that point. And then Titanfall is pretty much Call of Duty with mechs, and it's awesome.
It's Call of Duty.
Titanfall is way more than that, because it's got all of its... because it has such its emphasis on movement mechanics and a different match flow, but yeah.
Yeah. I love the Titanfall games. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm also wondering, okay, so for the most hilariously extreme version of this, how many sequels to Disco Elysium are there currently in the works?
There are approximately 5 different companies making something that is
5 now. I was thinking 4.
Wow. Oh, wow.
All of them claiming to be spiritual sequels to Disco Elysium, which is probably the most Disco Elysium thing ever.
Oh, yeah, no. I finally convinced my brother to start playing that. I'm happy. I'm getting to listen to his opinions. He chose a very different build than I do. I'll be interested to see how that goes for him.
I did a build where the one time I tried to fight somebody, he just knocked me out in one hit and I died. Yeah.
I was so physically disinclined that I sat in a chair and it killed me.
yeah. That's great.
But, I did have way too much encyclopedia, because when I make a character in a game, I always accidentally make them autistic. It just keeps happening. But let's see. Okay. Joke endings are joke endings, and people will understand if you have to do weird things to get them, but what about the best endings, the endings people want most, with esoteric or extremely difficult requirements?
Okay.
How many of you here have reached ending A of Valkyrie profile? It is an ambition of mine that has gone unfulfilled, a dream deferred. Let's see. What the hell is seal value? Nothing that is worth keeping in your mind. I do think there's thematic value sometimes in hiding the best ending behind very specific things. I think a lot about how they took away something thematic from how you got Persona 4's true ending when they made Golden. That, like, I get why they did it, but I do like the way that they did it before, even though it definitely pissed people off.
Yeah, I never played the original, but I got the bad ending in Golden, and it's like, I don't know, I didn't feel right about it, but I didn't know how far back I'd have to go to do it the right way.
For any ending in Persona 4 is that you never have to go back more than a conversation.
Yeah, so that's the thing. After it happened, I'm like, what do I do now? And then it turns out there was a save file, right before you make the pivotal choice. And so, in case anyone's wondering, in the bad ending of Persona 4 Golden, Nanako is in a coma, the fog takes over the whole city, and you end up killing the wrong person who wasn't even the actual murderer.
That's actually the bad ending in the original. There are new bad endings in Persona 4 Golden.
In Golden, after I got the bad ending and then made different choices, then it was like, okay, well now you get a whole nother semester and you get the winter stuff, and it's like, oh, okay, but then you still had to like get Marie's link to 10, I think.
Yeah, but that's also not the quote unquote true ending.
Okay, what is the true ending?
Well, the true ending is the bit where you go in and defeat Izanami and remove the fog from the TV world.
Okay.
But
you got to max out Margaret's link, right?
No. Oh. There's no link requirement for this.
Okay.
You just have to, at the end of the game, if you were paying attention... in Golden, all you have to do is go back to Juness, and it'll ask you if you want to call everyone in, and that'll open up the true ending.
Oh.
In
everything the original, great at your Juness.
So, in the original, there was an attempt to tie into the thematic underpinning of the game, which is, like, ignoring easy answers and trying to find the truth even as people try to hide it from you.
Okay.
So in the original version, if you tried to, you had to talk to all the S-links that you had maxed out, and then when you, the game will prompt you, like, do you want to go home and, like, activate the ending? And you have to say no. Then you go to Juness. If you try to access the, like, meeting area, it will say, like, there's nothing to do here. Do you want to go home? You have to say no again, and then try to try the same thing again, and then it'll say, is there a reason you're trying to do this? Do you need to get everyone together? Like, that was definitely irritating to people, because it required you to ignore the game's own UI. There was something to do.
Wow.
I get why that pissed people off, but it was more thematically correct.
Boy, I thought Symphony of the Night was bad, huh?
But yeah, like, it was more...
I was going to say, what would be worse would be Shin Megami Tensei 4's neutral ending originally.
Like, that is a very bad implementation of what they were attempting.
Yeah,
but I think I always loved the in the Disgaea games, there's certain fights where if you lose, or maybe you have to lose on purpose, you know, but there's so many alternate endings that, you know, joke endings in those games, just, you know, losing specific fights. And then, yeah. No, I thought that was neat. And I'm trying to think, what was the other? Yeah.
The original Disgaea actually had some, like, some weird ending conditions to get the good ending, because like it was something like if you had at any point accidentally killed one of your own demons, like used an attack that caused Laharl to kill the enemy, to kill your ally, like that would get you a like kind of sad ending that ends with Laharl as a prinny.
Oh, that's awesome. Laharl sucks.
Like that was a sign that his like that he had not really improved as a person.
yeah, I think
he needed to make some sort of sacrifice at the ending.
Okay, in four, like if you lose one of the fights against a measle, he's like, wait a minute, I actually won. How did this happen? Like, wow, you're terrible. If I could beat you.
I remember Disgaea 1, if you lose one of the battles against mid-boss, he's just like, I won, yes, start the music! And then he plays rolls credits on you, and you have to restart the game.
Yeah.
But I do like...
At least for Disgaea 1, when you restarted, you rolled over stats and levels and stuff, or at least you could. I think you did.
Yeah.
Did you?
The other game with awesome joke endings was, of course, the Blaze Blue games, because, yeah, it's help me, Kokonoe, and she's like, all right, listen, if you arrived here, you did something wrong. So she gives you hints on what you could have done differently. But the original one, Calamity Trigger, there were certain fights where it's like you had to win with, like, an astral finisher or something, and I don't know, like, I never got 100% in that game because it just, the endings made no sense, and they never told you the requirements. But
yeah, I didn't get far into that game's story mode because I just found it indescribably boring. But
yeah,
I didn't even know that it had all sorts of weird alternate things.
Yeah, and then one of the later games has a very funny one where I think Ragna and Jin end up. Yeah, they end up on like a desert island, but then there's weird kind of like. Like, no, Jin's acting all weird. He's like, brother! You know, and Ragna's like, what are you doing, man? And then he's like, trying to like make out with him or something. He's like, you're my brother, what are you doing? It's funny, though. Because Jin is just insane in those games.
That's definitely them also responding to the way the fandom had reacted to these two characters.
get away from me! Ugh. No, and I don't know. It's great. There's just, yeah, so many joke endings in those games, and Kokonoe trying to, like, so the big thing is just the fact that Ragna is good even though he represents chaos, and Jin is evil even though he represents order. That was the whole thing. Yeah. So then Kokonoe is kind of nudging you like, well, once you know that, and then I don't know this circumstance, but I know like after getting to that screen and her saying that, I'm like, oh, I know what I have to do. Yeah. So. Anyways.
Okay.
Hooray for joke endings.
Yeah, I'll just leave with, I think that it will almost always reduce the mass appeal of a title to hide the best ending behind like specific thematic behavior, but I think it makes those endings much more memorable to do so.
Like the way they did it in Aria of Sorrow, not Aria of Sorrow.
Yeah, like that's a cool one. Aria is the one where you have to equip the souls that mirror Dracula's attacks.
Yeah. That's a cool one. It's hard as hell, but I enjoyed the real last boss of Hollow Knight.
Nice.
And how it's hidden. I can't think of anyone else on this
option. Shall we get to the... have we done the question that's on the website?
We have not.
Okay. Since we just mentioned Hollow Knight, it's like, okay. Good segue there.
That's true. Do you have it pulled up?
Yeah. Okay. Right here.
They see crawl. Me roll on. I segue.
So, on episode 427, Metroids. There we go.
Nice to Metroids.
Here, Wheels is starting to enjoy Hollow Knight. Never understood the Q&A team's antipathy. Though you are all entitled to your own opinions, and I never felt it invalidates my personal evaluation. However, that said, what other games have you bounced off for some reason, only to find a new appreciation on a later encounter?
Ooh, that's a long list.
A few times. Wheels does this a lot. I've done this a few times.
Yeah, I will say like,
Wheels is a little contrarian troll.
I stand by my opinion, and I think Dave, based on his experience, hit the same thing. The beginning of Hollow Knight is deeply boring. I don't think I'm wrong in saying that.
It feels like it was designed to be played separately, like it was designed as a demo, and then like they didn't do quite enough to integrate it with the others, so it just sort of feels like just sort of like the first thing that you, like I was complaining about before, and I won't rehash this complaint too much, but the first thing that you actually get as a reward, like your first upgrade, is not exciting, which, yeah, that's why I bounced off. I'll get back to it.
Yeah. I mean, most of the stuff I've bounced off of, it's partly for technical reasons, like my computer can't play it properly, so I'm going to have to come back with a better computer later on. Yeah. So, I've got a list of games on Steam that I'm firmly intend to get back to at some point once I am fairly certain I can play them properly. So... we shall see in the future. But otherwise, I have butted heads on Unlimited Saga multiple times at this point. I hope that they just remake that game into a better system later. That's all I can say.
Don't think they will, but that would be nice.
Honestly, some... yeah, some of the Saga games actually just... it took me a time or two to get into Final Fantasy Legend 2 originally many, many, many years ago, but glad I did. And, yeah, just that kind of thing.
I guess technically I could say Romancing Saga 2 I did not get into the first time, even though the way I got into it was by playing the remake. Not sure if that counts. But not, I now appreciate the original...
yeah. I still love the original. It's one of those where you can just imagine that if they had actually released it internationally back then, it probably would have been very popular and a classic. Probably. It's showing its age anytime you get into it past the year 2000.
But hey, no,
now, the first Romancing Saga, no, we can be thankful that one never came out internationally. So. Actually, one of the issues I'm having on Romancing Saga 3 right now is trying to remember where stuff actually happens, because there aren't a lot of plot leads for anything. It's like, I'm fairly certain that there's some sort of adventure in this area, and I just need to find it somehow. And I found it, but I had no clues as to anything happening yet. So, compared to the previous two games in its series, it has very little sign that there's something to do. I guess is the right way to say it.
Yeah. I really bounced off of Destiny, but then tried it again. I think it would have been the Fallen King expansion. And then it was like, oh, okay, I like this better. And then I think Overwatch was another game where I liked it at first, bounced off hard, and then got back into it years later on PC when they added more characters, and it was like, okay, this is better. Of course, then I bounced off it again, and I don't know. So there's a lot of games that I'm having trouble answering this question, because there's a lot of games that I have bounced off of and tried again and then bounced off of again. Like, there's games I keep bouncing off of, and it's like, why do I keep trying to play this? So I don't know. I've been bouncing off of God of War 2018 since it came out, and I was just playing it the other day, and I'm just like, I want to finish this, but it's like, man, some of the side content is so tedious. I don't know why I'm even doing it.
I'll do the side content.
Yeah, that's my advice to anyone who wants to play that game. Just go to the lowest difficulty, ignore the side content, and don't try to fight the stupid Valkyries, man. Just don't do it. They're awful. Yeah. But it's just, I really want to play God of War Ragnarok because it got amazing review scores and it got Game of the Year and all these awards, and it was on sale for $20, and I'm like, well,
did it.
Let's see what the fuss is all about.
I saw all kinds of people not liking that very much.
Oh,
or as much as the first game.
Oh,
it's just kind of more of the same. So if you really like the first game, you'll probably enjoy it, but it's not going to surprise you like the first one. Then again, the first one didn't really surprise me because it was like, oh, you just went back and like made a knockoff of the actual best game of the year, God of War first came out. let's see. But yeah, for ones I've turned around on in the past, The one that actually immediately comes to mind is not really in the RPG realm, but it was Trauma Center Under the Knife, which the first time I bounced off of, because I was like, why is this so goddamn hard? But eventually I, like, just went back to it, and, like, I was able to stop being pissed off about it and learned to enjoy it. But I do this, like, every few years I'll go back to at least one game that I played and was like, I don't like this or care for it or maybe even hate it, and sometimes I'll get a new perspective on things. Some of the like eternal candidates that I try this with, and it's not yet worked, but we'll see, because I'm sure I'm not done with trying it. One of the ones that immediately comes to mind is Okami, a game that I think is just drastically too long. But you know, there's others that are just on that list. I'm sure that you know, like, I mean, I might try God of War 2018 at some point. I might try The Last of Us 1 at some point. I bounced off both of those. I thought that they were quite boring. And
they're actually very similar, and it's
extraordinarily similar.
It's Sony trying to just be more. Didn't they say at one point, we want to be more cinematic? And I'm like, no, you need to be less cinematic.
They're trying to be very cinematic, and they're approaching that from the angle of like game developers who have bad relationships with their kids, and somehow that's turning into the plot of the game.
Yeah, pretty much.
But yeah, like, you know, speaking of people putting way too much of themselves into games, but and you know, the way I'll put it is that, like, if you're the director of a AAA game, it's almost impossible to have like a work-life balance that allows you to have like a healthy relationship with your children. So that's why this keeps fucking happening. But yeah, let's see.
Yeah, like, I don't so much bounce off of games as just I get a new game and I just want to try it out, especially if it's a PC game. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure it launches, and I want to mess around with settings and see, you know, see if I get good performance, decide if I want to refund it or not, you know, on Steam. So it's less so bouncing off and more so just I just wanted to load it once to make sure it works, and then I kind of go back to whatever I was playing before and forget about it. So, Like, that's why I only played 13 minutes of Demon School, because that was enough to just get through the first tutorial battle of the game, you know, and to make sure the game would actually launch and not crash. So.
Why only 13 minutes? Why did you bounce off of it?
I'm going to play it more, I swear.
Uh-huh.
It just didn't immediately grab your interest.
You play it more, and you know, the rest of your Steam library is like stomping their feet impatiently, like Sonic and 16-bit games.
Yeah. You know, in Sonic CD, if you make him wait long enough, he bounces. He just jumps off the screen, and yeah, it's great.
And then you get a game over, regardless of how many lives you had left.
Amazing. Maybe that's the one thing I like about Sonic CD.
I like Sonic CD a lot. It's a weird game.
Yeah.
I'm liking weird games. Plague of All Screen.
I don't know what that is.
I told you about it for like half an hour. You were too busy playing Destiny.
It's true. I don't remember anything about it. I'm sorry.
You fly a shoe around.
And then there are dolphins.
Yeah, there are dolphins. There's a picture of it in the Discord. You'll see it later.
Did I hear a rumor that Sega wants to do another Echo the Dolphin game?
That's not a rumor.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the people involved are like the original Echo creator is involved, but he's like a crazy AI guy now, so it's gonna look like shit.
No.
Okay, so some quick ones before we close out, because my throat is giving out. I asked months ago about the ending of Monty Python and the Holy Grail and the fact that artists sometimes smell something horrible from their work and so make it ironic to cover it up. Still isn't as bad as saying it's satire instead of ironic. I can name a few examples, like the Mighty Mouse cartoon, A Novel Named Notes from the Internet, Apocalypse, and Rick and Morty. What do you have? I can't think of a lot in terms of games where just because... where someone just like gives up for an ending.
I mean, it's not uncommon for a game to have a weak third act just because most of the money gets put into the start of the game.
The realities of game development. But I can't think of many where
that's a different.
I can't think of many where like they give up and turn it into a shitpost.
I mean, maybe Contact. Just because I hit the end of that game, I was convinced it was the midpoint of the game because it really felt like leading up to a Final Fantasy VI style midpoint, and then having the hero join forces with the former enemies to take out the professor. But no, it just ended.
It turns out he doesn't want anything to do with you anymore.
I mean, I was just like, at the end, I was like, that's it? It's like, this feels like the first half of a game, and you just took away the more interesting half. I'm pretty sure that's not a case of Suda51 giving up. It's more just like, you just thought it was funny to do it.
Yeah. While that was a Grasshopper manufactured game, Suda's involvement was minimal, if anything. It was directed by a man named Akira Ueda. But,
okay, then let's blame it on Ueda.
Yeah, but in any case, that was just for, you know, credit where it's due, or blame. But I get this. I feel like, given Grasshopper Manufacture, I think this is probably Contact is probably what it is on purpose. Just confrontational. This was intentional. He worked briefly at Love It Alike.
I mean, who didn't work with Love It Delic at some point in the 90s?
It's true. I'm just saying, like, that if anyone did that on purpose, not as a shitpost,
it was somebody connected to Love It Delic, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
See, yeah, he was. He. Because he had. He was hired by Square in 1990, worked mostly as a background map designer, most prominently on Super Mario RPG, like most of the Love It Alike people, and joined co-worker Kenichi Nishi and others in the establishment of Love of the Leak.
Lovadelic. It's supposed to sound like psychedelic.
I gotcha. But he left Lovadelic and joined Grasshopper Manufacturer in 1999. So, yeah.
I didn't realize Grasshopper was that old.
Okay. Yeah, that's right around when they're established, because they, like, Suda leaves Human Entertainment around that time, just before Human Entertainment implodes.
I still remember when the Moon remake remaster came out, and Famitsu had the 2-page spread that was basically just a family tree of all of the various games and game creators associated with Lovadelic and Moon RPG Remix Adventure. And it's just like, this is a really absurd list of games to have somehow share a DNA.
But, yeah, no. But the thing that's horrible and nightmarish about it is that when you see the, when you play them, it's like, it, with that knowledge, it's like, no, I absolutely see where it came from, even if it's complete nonsense.
I'm just like,
yeah. Okay.
Rule of Rose and Rosie Rupee Land.
Yep.
I mean, Stray Children has an entire area that includes Rule of Rose references.
Yep.
Yeah.
Someone had to.
It's crazy.
Yeah, well, I've talked about this game before, of course, but Pillars of Eternity 2, there's a joke ending where right at the beginning you can refuse to take the quest, and then you get reincarnated as a dog. And then the ending of the game, basically nothing you do matters. So it's not that the hero gives up per se, it's that they fail their quest regardless of what you do, and they're forced to just leave, you know? So you finally catch up to the giant god who's been wreaking havoc, and you're supposed to be stopping him somehow, and he's basically like, mm-hmm. Well, you can't stop me. So if you try to fight him, he just squishes you with his giant hand and you die. But basically, yeah, your quest is to stop him, but you can't stop him. And then he does what he's going to do anyways. And then lo and behold, the world doesn't end or anything. And you're told, oh, well, actually, this is just going to start like a new era for the world. It's like, well, then what the fuck was I doing for the past 40 hours? So...
Checking the inevitable under a very poor misconception of the concept of break the shell of the world.
Yeah. I guess.
New world struggles to be born.
Right. You're told that he's going to end the world, and then he's like, no, I'm not going to do that. And then he does what he wants to do. Yeah, and then the other gods who put you on this quest just pretty much lied to you, I guess. I don't know. But then it also does the thing where you, if you want to keep playing, you have to go back to a save file that's like 2 or 3 hours earlier before you enter the final area. And it's like, oh, well, that's silly. So you don't even get to see the new world. You go back and as if it never happened. Yeah. Oh.
Okay, one more question and then we call it a night. I've already asked about worthless unlockables that you gain after beating the game, but what about the opposite? Like, if you beat Chaos Legion with the English voiceover, you unlock the Japanese dub. If you beat it with the Japanese voiceover, you unlock the English dub. I'm not sure how that's opposite, but I assume we're talking about things that you beat the game and it's completely... It changes your experience if you replay it.
Well, all I can think of is when you get all 150 stars in Mario 64, then you find Yoshi and he gives you like 100 extra lives. And I'm like, well, I don't need those anymore. I did everything.
He also gives you a super triple jump.
Yeah, it's like, when the hell am I going to use that? I beat all the levels. I got all the stars. I don't want to play anymore.
Can't imagine not wanting to play anymore.
Why did this final boss give me so much experience and gold that I am never going to use?
So I'm going to bring up one that I happen to be fond of, which is the original Jumping Flash was a like early 3D platformer. First person, you get like an enormous triple jump. And if you beat the game, for some reason on New Game Plus, you get to jump 6 times without touching the ground.
Wow.
So you can just do really stupid shit in all the levels. That's fun. I like that.
Yeah.
You can get places you shouldn't be. God bless Jumping Flash.
Well, then in all of the FromSoft, you know, Souls-like games, you usually the final boss will give you a really cool, like, well, in Dark Souls, yeah, you get the soul of the final boss, which of course you can't do anything with until you go, or like, okay, you know what, specifically Dark Souls 1, after you beat Gwyn, Lord of Cinder, it automatically goes into the ending and goes into New Game Plus. So then you got to play until you reach Anor Londo, so the blacksmith can help you make whatever item you can make with his soul. But it's kind of like, if you're like me and you're going to play through the game 3 times and try to get the Platinum Trophy or whatever, then great. Actually, in Dark Souls, there's 3 different items you can make with Soul of Sif, and you need to make all 3 to get the Platinum Trophy. So that game, you have to play through that game at least 3.5 times to get the Platinum, because you got to get to Anor Londo to make the 3rd item with the 3rd copy of Soul of Sif. Yeah.
Yes, there's another thing you could do also.
What?
Not get the trophy, because it's dumb.
You could just beat the game once and then move on with your life. Yes. Yeah. This is true. Oh, and then, of course, Resident Evil, you know, getting like the rocket launcher for beating it in under, what, 90 minutes or on the highest difficulty or whatever. And it's like, well, I don't need this now. Yeah. It's still fun. Yeah, you know what, though? It is fun to play through a Resident Evil game with an infinite ammo rocket launcher and just one-shot every freaking zombie in that game.
It changes the dynamic.
Yeah. So, I suppose it is fun, but at the same time, it's like, well, I don't need this now.
Resident Evil does it because it is cathartic.
Yeah. Because
suddenly you are allowed to just run through and you have nothing to fear.
Right. That's true. But I'm just trying to think of the requirements to get the Infinite Rocket Launcher and the Resident Evil 1 remake. But then I do seem to recall that I was able to use it to beat the game on the highest difficulty, which was no longer hard at all. I mean, you just couldn't really get hit too many times. But what I did do, I don't know why I did this again, you know what, chasing after a Platinum Trophy, I did beat that game on Invisible Enemy mode, and I did beat that game on the real survival mode, where you don't get to use any of the infinite weapons. So, yeah. I don't know why I did that.
This is the only thing that is making me think of right now is another Crab's Treasures interesting difficulty menu, but where there's a toggle that just says "Give the crab a gun."
Crab that gun.
And so you can have the gun. You can have the crab with a six shooter strapped to his back and shooting everything in the game. Sorry, just fine, going funny.
That's pretty awesome.
That's another game I need to play sometime, but I've been told that the difficulty toggles are very interestingly granular. Beyond just give the crap a gun, which I'm absolutely going to do at some point. Okay, right. Sorry.
And of course, we'll never forget that you beat Metal Gear Solid and you get either the bandana or the stealth suit. And that will make your next playthrough much more interesting. Yeah, either way. Mm-hmm. Okay. Did we answer the question?
I'm not quite sure.
Sometimes I'm like, did I actually answer the question properly? Who knows?
The answer is, I like questions. I like stories, but yeah, no, we did, because we were talking about like things that changed the game afterwards, and then we got on the tangent, which means we're getting punchy and it's time to go to sleep. So, hey.
Okay, good.
Tell me more about other books I can get besides folk tales.
Tell me about princesses who hang out in pizza parlors.
Well, I mean, I'm almost through with episode 14 in The Notebook, which is nice. Yeah. Getting there.
Good.
Big fight scene. Yay. But yeah, so, yes, Princesses of the Pizza Parlor. Soon to be 14 episodes. As I need to finish this up. Type it up, which is a different issue, and get a cover. But yes, so 13 available episodes, 5 side stories, and one self-indulgently long paralogue novel, all about just enjoying games. But all the weird lore and world building I can just stick in there just for giggles. I have some fun with this. Still very nicely priced, considering I'm not adjusting for inflation at all at this point. So, for the price of a decent dinner for one out in any given American city at this point, I think you can get all the entire series easy. So, that says more about the inflation in America than anything else.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Yeah, let's just say, even vacationing in Canada last summer was a massive sticker shock all around. But yeah. But yeah, obviously I'm not doing this to make money. I'm doing this because I want people to look at my books. Yay. My book. And then otherwise we have Vainglorious, Long as the Night, Lit RPG, Metroidvania, B-movie, heavily B-movie themed. And I just realized it has one thing in common with Contact. And that they both make it weak point for massive damage jokes.
Man, Contact was quick on that. That was a 2006 video game.
Yes. No, it was a little later than that, because I was actually working at the site, on the site here, when it came out in English. So it had to be 2007 or later. So. But yeah. Just one of many very random references and jokes that I put into that book. Like I had to tell my dad once, it's like, and jokes are a present for the author, not for the audience.
Yeah.
Yeah. If the author can make the audience appreciate the in-joke, it's good, even if they don't actually understand what it is. Bear that in mind when you're reading my stuff. And then other than that, everything mentioned so far, including the Japanese folktale stuff earlier, is under Michael Yarimizu, Yarimizu. And under a different pen name, Michael Spearwater, we have a romantasy travelogue that's just, again, basically me not expecting to make any money off of this, but I like that it exists. Just be sure to read the description on Amazon and determine whether or not you would actually want to read it before grabbing it, because I do not wish you to be improperly surprised here. Okay.
All right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, so, yeah, under Michael Spearwater, a Wager for Wanderlust, Romantasy, Travelogue, just have fun. Okay, thank you.
Let's see. Joe, tell us where we can watch you.
Yeah, so I jumped on late and wasn't very talkative. I was eating food, so I didn't want to talk with my mouth full. Obviously, that would be rude. So, so last week on Thursday night, I decided that was going to be my last Pokemon stream, Legends EA. And so I'm in the, what I'm calling the post-post game, because it's the post-credits part of the DLC. And basically, I reached a point where I could not enter the portals to challenge the remaining legendaries, because you need specific donuts and I didn't have the right berries I thought, well, that's fine. You know, that's something where there's still some more post-game stuff to do in the DLC area, and there's still plenty of side quests and other things. So I put like 80 hours into that game. I think it's good to walk away from it for a while and just maybe finish that on my own time, because you can get, I think it's Rayquaza or whatever his name is. Rayquaza, sorry. The flying green dragon dude. That kind of looks like a bunch of Legos stuck together. I think. and so then there's two other legendaries you have to challenge first. But again, to get into their portals, you get these special donut recipes, and I don't even know where to find the freaking berries that you need to get those stats on those donuts there. But anyways, that means that going forward, Tuesday, Thursday nights, I'm going to be doing more Rune Factory, Guardians of Azuma, until I get my copy of East 10 Proud Nordics. So I should be getting a PS5 copy of that that launches February 20th. So I probably won't get release date delivery, but that's the plan. The plan is Rune Factory until I get East. And but that's it. So yeah, Tuesday and Thursday nights on twitch.tv/rpgamer. I am Smokin' Joe Gamer, so that's what I do those two nights. So starting around 10 p.m. Eastern time on Tuesday, 9 p.m. Eastern time on Thursday. And nobody streams after me, so sometimes I go for about 2 hours, sometimes it's three. You know, if I'm not that tired and I, you know, and I feel like going later, then I will. Beyond that, I haven't been doing much on my own Twitch channel under Smokin' Joe Gamer. You can check out my YouTube channel. I got a whole bunch of videos there. And recently, a bunch of people watched the speedrun I did of Night Manor from the UFO 50 collection. I was able to get through that game quickly without dying and get the best ending. Oh, gee, that would have been something to talk about before, huh? Getting the best ending in that game, you have to get through it without dying.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Oof.
And it's tough. Because if the killer catches you, you got to play this little mini game where a bar goes back and forth and you got to hit it at just the right time, and it gets faster and faster. So it took me several tries to be able to beat that game without dying. So in the good ending, the hero gets away cleanly without getting infected or anything. So it's pretty good. So apparently a bunch of people watched that recently and commented on it. So I'm like, okay, hey, great. You know, I made that video several months ago, but that's the thing with YouTube. You know, the algorithm weaves as the algorithm wills, right? So, and maybe it recommends my videos to people, maybe it doesn't, but I got over 400 videos on YouTube under Smokin' Joe Gamer. And, also you can follow me on Blue Sky if you'd like. I mostly shit posting, right? You know, just try to have fun on there. I post jokes. I talk about things that I like. Sometimes I post political opinions, but I really don't want to be that kind of account at this point. I'd rather just try to have fun on there and make people laugh, you know?
All right.
I think that's important. So that's where you can find me if you'd like. And that's all I got. Yep.
Okay. So yeah, I would like to let you all know that you can ask us questions by catching us when we stream, typically in the 8:30 p.m., 8:30 p.m. Pacific, 11:30 p.m. Eastern range every night. We started a little early tonight because, I mean, I don't need a good reason. This is necessary for me. But otherwise, you can also catch our sister show Shenanigans, which occurs every Sunday at 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern. I don't think I said a day, but normally we record on 8:30 on Mondays at 8:30 p.m. Pacific, 11:30 p.m. Eastern. If you go to twitch.tv/rpgamer or twitch.tv/askwheel, we try to keep track of the chat. So if you want to ask us questions in real time, there's your option. You can also ask us questions like dear friend Krull did in the RP Gamer comment section. We try to keep track of those. You can also ask us questions in the RP Gamer Discord, which you can get access to by going to the community tab on rpgamer.com and clicking the invite link, as long as you haven't gotten yourself banned for some reason.
Okay. Has that happened recently?
Not that I can think of, but I mean, if it happened, you wouldn't be able to get in there whenever.
Right. Well, sometimes we do get some people who join and they're weird or they're obviously bots, and yeah, don't be that guy. Away. Don't be weird.
Don't be a bot. Listen to us if you're a bot.
Dear bots, don't be a bot. Don't be such a bot.
But yeah. Yeah.
So is that under the podcast channel on Discord?
Yeah, that's where we're looking for questions.
Okay, because I have not seen any in there. I checked it the other day.
Yeah, there hasn't been for a while.
So. Oh, okay. But that makes me sad.
You can always add something in there if you want.
It makes us happy when you ask us questions. Ask.
The questions. And thanks once again to Crawl and Fire Miner, some of our long-running questioners. Yeah, otherwise, I think that probably about wraps it up. So, you know, my usual outros. See you, Space Cowboy.
See ya.
It's me, Mario! This is Mole Man in the morning. Good Mole Man to you.
It's a dreadful combination.
Oh, no. It's me, a Mole Man!
It stinks!
There you go.